In this episode, we're talking about two dirty words, negative gearing. And to really ramp it up, we'll also bring up the capital gains tax discount. And we're going to explore why negative gearing is back in the headlines. We'll address some common misconceptions, whether or not it's inevitable that the current arrangements will change. And if they do, could the government tinker at the edges or go in boots and all now that they've broken their stage 4 tax cuts election promise without incurring the wrath of the electorate?
Welcome to The Elephant in the Room. This is the podcast where we love to talk about the big things in property that never usually get talked about. I'm Veronica Morgan, real estate agent, buyer's agent and buyer's agent mentor, co-host of Foxtel's Location, Location, Location Australia, author of Auction Ready and co-host of Your First Home Buyer Guide.
And I'm Chris Bates, mortgage broker, recently ranked number 5 in Australia out of over 18,000 brokers in the annual MPA Top 100 Mortgage Broker Awards. Before we get started, I need to let you know that nothing we say here can be taken as personal advice. We always recommend you engage the services of an appropriate and experienced professional.
Right, today we're tackling the whole topic of negative gearing. It's back on the agenda, whether the government's admitting to it or not. So we want to dig into what's it all about and whether or not something we need to be worried about and what we should be thinking about as property investors.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big topic. I think we were covered a lot about this back in 2018, 2019, housing market downturn across the country. You know, we saw investors really driving the previous boom. And so there was a real reason, a rhetoric that investors are pushing out first home buyers and negative gearing is the reason for house price and property price growth. And there was a story there because, yeah, that boom was driven a lot by investors. But it is back on the table now just because there is a home affordability crisis. And, you know, people think, oh, well, what's that for? It's because of our tax settings, and negative gearing and capital gains tax are back on the table again. So what's sort of some of the headlines you've seen, Veronica?
Well, there's been a number, but I guess the real reason that it's back in the headlines is because the federal government is trying to legislate a new housing plan. And it's all around this affordability thing. And it's called a Help to Buy package. And in order to get it through, they're going to need crossbench support. And they're also going to, they're going to need the Greens, right? But the Greens have announced that they'll use this as an opportunity to get negative gearing and capital gains tax, the discount anyway, on the political agenda. So in negotiations with the government over that Help to Buy legislation, they've said that they're going to push Labor to end the tax handouts to big property investors, I'm quoting here, freeze rents and build public housing to help renters and first home buyers. And that's what Greens leader Adam Banter said. Now, he and his party are arguing that negative gearing and capital gains concessions are making it easier for investors to buy multiple homes than it is for someone to buy their first home. Now, we're going to unpack that a bit as we move through here. We don't agree with it completely. It's on face value, it's all very emotive. But the reality is that what it makes it easy to buy multiple homes is a high income. And it's so deductions are really icing on the cake. And we're going to dig further into that. But also someone else who's weighed into this is former New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet, and he's called for negative gearing reforms to be put back on the table as part of a wider debate about how tax reform could address housing affordability. Now, he is known as, when he was Premier, to try to move away from stamp duty to a broad-based land tax. So he actually put his money where his mouth was and tried to do something quite radical. That was wiped off the table when New South Wales government changed to Labor government, Chris Minns came. We absolutely agree that it needs to be negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions need to be part of a wider debate, and there needs to be a big picture tax return, reform, I should say, not this populist feel-good tinker at the edges. And Perrottet has said that, you know, housing has become a burning issue for Australians, both for those that can't afford a home and they're worried about their kids as well, but also for buyers and renters. And so obviously he's saying that there could be an opportunity for governments to take a political risk, but at the same time, it's going to be a big election issue, I would think. So that's the reason it's on the front pages at the moment.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these sort of discussions aren't as black and white. There's lots of unintended consequences that can happen. A lot of where you think it's going to really impact, it doesn't. And where it does, you didn't think it would impact, it really does. And I think that this is, which was our conversation back in 2019, the, you know, the idea of just getting rid of negative gearing would have solved housing affordability and made property prices cheaper across the whole country. And but that's not what we expect to happen, right? You know, we think that some areas will make it even more desirable to own or occupy, less desirable on investment properties. And you'll see this, you know, fraction, the challenges will happen in different ways. And so, I mean, is it worth us going through what negative gearing is? I mean, you know, is it just having a conversation around, because I do think it's a bit misunderstood, right? I do think that, you know, if there was a change to negative gearing, does that mean that people who bought properties in the past, do they then lose their negative gearing benefits? Is it done retrospectively, or is there like a line in the sand? Is it, you know, a whole portfolio? If you've got 10 properties, is your whole portfolio, if that's positively geared, can you still claim the negative gearing on individual properties? Like, we don't know these sort of things. And so a lot of people who use negative gearing are actually first home buyers, or first time investors. And so, you know, they want to use the benefits of negative gearing because it's the only way to enter the market is to leverage their money. Whereas the older generation who have got those multiple properties, a lot of the time they have got positive gearing, or they've got cash to make it positive. And so maybe they're not too concerned about that going. So I think that's the real conversation, I believe, around this topic, is unintended consequences of policy change and how, you know, making one change may not do exactly what society leads you to believe.
Let's talk about what negative gearing is. But, you know, as you were saying that, Chris, my mind was cast back to 2018, and I did a lot of research about this, and we did talk about it a lot on the podcast. And, it, you know, it's the way you spin the numbers, right? So we've got some data coming up. We'll sort of let you know some of the facts, right? But so one of the facts is that the highest dollar value is tends to be given to or in the tax returns of higher income people. Right. So if you look at the dollar value, however, if you look at the number of people actually claiming negative gearing, the proportion is higher in the lower tax brackets. So the dollar value is higher. And but if they pulled it out and said how many individuals are getting it that are in the higher tax brackets, a hell of a lot smaller than it is in. So the back then in 2018, if my memory serves me well, the rhetoric was 80% of the tax money, you know, the money that taxpayers are paying to give to these greedy landlords is being paid to high income earners. But when they actually looked at the amount of people actually claiming negative gearing, 80% of the people were in the lower tax bracket. So you know, it's just how you shift with the numbers, right? It's lying with statistics, right? But what is negative gearing? Well, negative gearing is a tax concession that applies when the cost of owning an investment outweighs the income it generates. Now, with property, you know, we've got two elements to why you would invest. One is the income, the rent that you get, right? And the other is the capital growth. And the premise with negative gearing is that as you when you buy a property in the early years, you owe a lot of money. The rent is unlikely going to cover the mortgage and certainly won't. And when interest rates rise, it doesn't tend to cover the interest portion of that mortgage. And so your costs outweigh the income you're getting, and you're able to offset that against your income, right? So that's basically, reduce your tax bill. But the thing that is not often talked about when it comes to this rhetoric around property is it can apply to any kind of investment, right? Now, it's most commonly associated with investment properties because people borrow more when they're buying investment properties than they do when they're buying shares, for argument's sake. But the fact is, it's not just property investors that can get access to negative gearing.
Well, absolutely. It could be buying shares. You could be starting a business. You know, like when you're taking out debt to, you know, try to produce capital growth or grow that money and create an income, then you got to question, if they do it just for property, what are they going to do? Are they going to make it in a sub-ruling that you can do it for shares up to certain limits? Are they going to ban it completely, you know, day one? Are they going to put a cap on it? Like there's, you know, there's... That's what I think when there is a bit of misunderstanding. I think a lot of people driving the end of negative gearing, unfortunately, the people who probably want to use it, who would potentially want to use it over the next couple of decades, right? The people who aren't driving into the people who have got all the benefits of negative gearing. So it's kind of like, you know, what baby boomers have had the benefit of negative gearing and the prices. Now, if you say that, oh, I want to get rid of negative gearing because it's going to make housing affordable when I want to buy, but then a few years later, you want to buy an investment property, do something. Well, you haven't got that option, right? and maybe it has some reduced prices where you want to buy, because that market's been driven by owner-occupiers. And when you end a negative gearing, you basically make it less enticing to invest. And so what more people will do is actually put more money into their homes. And that'll actually drive up the owner-occupier rate in these suburbs. So I think that's it. This is sort of the discussions that I think are really important around negative gearing, is that, you know, these other discussions that aren't just as blanket of let's just get rid of it and, you know, that'll solve our issues.
Yeah. Now, look, of course, negative gearing is controversial, because while it is standard practice to be able to write off business costs, we're talking about, you know, you start a business and you've got some incurred some losses there, you can write them off. Because you're writing that off against business revenue, right? But in Australia, the ability to offset these costs against personal income, that is a little unusual, you know, compared to around the world. So that is one sort of argument, I guess, in favour of, you know, looking at this, because it's like, we, as Australian property investors, we've got access to something that a lot of people in other countries don't have. Now, we're not going to go into all the things that are available across the world here, but it's just something we're trying to be balanced in what we're talking about. But the other thing, that negative gearing only works on the premise that you're going to make capital gains, right? So the whole point is that if you're going to lose money, why would you invest in a property? If you know you're going to lose money, why would you invest in a property? And that's why property investing does have to be considered with both the income side of things and the capital growth. Now, there's, to be quite frank, I think too much emphasis on the income side of property investment from people. But this is one of the things why it's so important to be considering capital growth when it comes to negative gearing, because if you don't achieve really good capital growth, solid capital growth, then it doesn't make sense at all to lose money. And even if you're negative gear, you're only getting back your proportion of tax that you pay anyway. You know, you're not getting back dollar for dollar, you're getting back 37 cents or whatever it is that your marginal tax rate is. So the thing is, what you're losing as an investor is you're losing cash flow, right? But you're not really losing money if the asset is increasing in value. And I think that's the reason that we invest, but I don't think enough property investors are really thinking like that way. And also, I think the problem with what's proposed is that investors will get lots of negative gearing. If they buy a brand new property, they're not going to get much in the way of capital growth to make it worthwhile. That's coming up as we unpack that.
Yeah, and I think obviously that's been has proven true over, you know, decades, that, you know, yes, people who potentially bought with a negative cash flow and they've got negative gearing benefits. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of talk around tax benefits. You know, that's what a lot of people think with negative gearing, is all these tax benefits and tax write-offs. Now, that can be true in the olden days where people, you know, used to buy a new property and, you know, get big depreciation benefits, and you know, that would blow out your negative gearing benefits, right? So you would get a huge tax refund, and that would offset your ongoing costs and potentially turn a negative gearing property very close to neutrally geared or positively geared, because you get this deduction with for depreciation and things like that. But yeah, I do think that the people that don't use negative gearing are the people who believe, don't understand that the reason you are potentially losing money is so you can make money. And then they head more down this positive cash flow and cash flow, you know, is going to make them rich sort of mentality, and they're not focusing on what drives the actual benefit of property is actually the capital growth. So
in fact, really, when I'm looking at property investment, I think that I want to see the yield go down, and it's a bit like saying I want to pay lots of tax. I want to pay lots of tax because I mean to earn lots of income. Like, you know, give me $1 million tax bill. I really want that because, you know, I want to earn the money that goes along with that. But and in regards to property investment, if you've got really low yield, that's because your capital growth is outstripping the way the rent grows. I want the value of the property to grow faster than the rent. I really do. And that's counterintuitive, because people sort of brag about the yield that they get. It's like, give me low yield every day. But anyway, that's just slightly contrarian of me. So the thing, Jeremy,
there's a second element to that. So there's two ways you can think about it. You're absolutely right. Your low yielding basically shows that the people are willing to spend a lot of money buying it, but they versus, you know, renting it. You know, they there's a real desire to own the property because they want the security, the stability, the lifestyle benefits that provides. But people wouldn't rent it for that much, but they'd absolutely to lock it in and to hold it long term. They're willing to pay a big price, way more than what makes sense from renting it. It's just because people want that stability. But yield can actually, even though it's going down, it depends on whether you use current prices or whether you use the price that you purchased it at. And
I'm talking about current prices, not the price of purchase to that. Yes,
absolutely. Mm. And you know, and so what sometimes people don't factor in is they say, okay, it's a 3% yield on today, but if you put up your rent 20%, well, that rent's just gone from 3 to 3.6 if you put your rents up. And so your yield can increase. And if yields are going up, if capital prices are going up, that what that basically means is that more or less people can afford to buy, more people are forced to rent, and then capital growth generally then leads to rentable growth down the line, because the capital growth is forcing people on higher incomes to then basically rent the properties. And so, yeah, absolutely. You know, that yield on the current price probably should be falling, because if it's not, that means that rental growth is outstripping capital growth. And that's not usually a great sign, because it means your asset's not likely growing in value that fast.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's sort of like two yields there. You've got my yield, which is literally the yield on the amount of money I've invested, versus the property's yield. And that's calculated on current market value. Now, obviously, if you're going to lose money in terms of cash flow so that you can then claim negative gearing, and the reason you're doing so is because you're convinced that you bought yourself a good asset, it's going to go up in value over time. One day, you're probably going to sell it. And when you sell it, you get a capital gains tax discount, right? And so that's been put forward as an argument that that's the only reason that people would be game enough to lose money and do this negative gearing thing, because they know that one day when they go to sell the property, they're going to get 50% discount on the capital gains tax, which means they only pay tax at their, well, which would be the top marginal rate, assuming most property sales, that you're going to pay tax on half the money. Now, unless you sell it within the first 12 months, in which case you pay full freight if you made a good profit on it. So I guess let's quickly just talk about why the capital gains tax concession exists. And also to point out, and this is something I don't think a lot of people understand, and that is if you claim negative gearing during the life of owning a property, when you do go to sell that property, those deductions that you've claimed get added back in. So it's not like, you know, it's like that gets added in as a profit, right? Is that the way it works, Chris?
From the depreciation point of view, yes. Like, so the depreciation you used from a reducing your cost base, so your that gets added back in. The other costs and interest and things like that don't.
But you're right.
And that is a big misconception where the white shoe brigade were pushing in the property spruiker world is you'd go to one of those seminars and they would absolutely say, when you do your income tax and you do this variation to your income and you can basically get all these big tax write-offs, very few would finish that story, right? And they would say, however, when you sell it one day, you bought this off-the-plan property for $500 and you claimed $100,000 of depreciation. Well, in the tax office eyes, you actually bought that for $400,000, not $500. So when you sell it for $550 or $500, what you purchased it for, you could be liable for capital gains, even though you actually didn't actually make much money because you produced your cost base due to depreciation. Absolutely, that basically reduces the income tax benefit of the depreciation up front. There's potentially still a margin there because CGTs at a lower rate than income tax, but it's nowhere near as big as what you believe. And so, it's a good pickup.
And the concessions exist because they factor in, or they make an adjustment for inflation so that you're not paying tax on inflation. And I think it was the Howard government that sought to simplify the whole calculation process of how to work out what the discount should be off the capital gains tax, because that was in a time of high inflation as well as in the 90s. And so they simplified the process, because you imagine from accountant's got to work out, right, so someone bought this property in 1974 and they sold it in 1999, and then if they bought it in 1974, they didn't have to pay capital gains tax, did they? So in 1980, they bought it in 1986 and they sold it in 1999. And so then there's, 13 years worth of growth. They've got to try and work out, they used to have to work out what the inflation rate was every year and make adjustments for that. Now, you can imagine your accountant, that's a lot of time and effort and money, and probably not that productive in terms of time. So the Howard government sought to simplify that by just putting a fixed flat rate of 50% as a deduction. Now, so you could argue, and we'll talk about some of the options that that may result in change, and you could argue it's too high currently because inflation, even in our high inflationary environment recently, was not as high as it was back in the 90s. You could argue that It needs to change over time. That, you know, if you sold a property after 2 years and you're getting a 50% deduction, that's too much. You know, maybe it needs to increase over time. So you could argue that really that's a bit overly simplified and no longer fit for purpose. So I think that there's some, you know, Perrottet talks about an overall reform, and I think that these are things that need to be looked at. Is it working? Is it appropriate? But that's pretty much where it came about. So people running around go, it's really unfair that people get a discount on tax, and they're not understanding that there is the inflation plays a part in this, and that's the reason for that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's where that might come up. I do think that's probably got more legs than a, you know, we have got ridiculously low vacancy rates, which is causing a rental crisis and pushing up rents. And so, you know, is it a time where the government can say, you know, let's go further attack new investments, right? We've already got this exodus of investors leaving the market. And so that if you under high interest rates, and one of the reasons why this negative gearing conversation is up right now is that the cost, which they talk, negative gearing is costing the Australian tax office, you know, X amount of billion, right? There's a cost there. Well, they actually are saving the government in some ways of having to provide housing, right? And we can't grow our population, and all the benefits of growing our population from a tax point of view, are they offsetting that cost of, you know, we providing that housing? And so I think that's a real issue right now. Like, how can you target investors when investors are already leaving and vacancy rates are at all-time lows, and we've got a homelessness problem? And yes, that may benefit first-time buyers, less investors. But sometimes first-time buyers are the investors. So maybe you say to the first-time buyer, actually, you know what? I know you wanted to go and buy an investment property rather than buying a home. Now you can't even do that. Now you've got to buy a home. Well, I can't afford to buy anyway. And they have to, are forced to buy an owner-occupier. So I think it's a real hard one, I think, to argue right now. I do think it's a bit miscited. However, changing capital gains tax, and particularly for people who are turning over and flipping, you know, in short time frames, you have to say that, you know, paying 25% tax, which is half of the, you know, top tax rate, is way better than paying full freight at 50%. And so, you know, if someone does make some property profits or gains in investing, then you're potentially only going to be paying 25% tax versus 50% tax. So it's heavily weighted to those who have got assets, growing their assets, because they can pay a much lower margin of tax on people who are making capital gains versus income tax. And I think that's up for debate. I think, you know, particularly on short-term investments, who's to say that discount doesn't get reduced from 50% to 25%? So now you're saying there's a 37.5% max tax, let's call it, or something around that, versus paying income tax in the high 40s. Okay, maybe that investing benefit isn't there, you know, and this is the inequality debate. Maybe we shouldn't be taxing incomes as much. Maybe we should tax people who are making investments more. And I think that's something that I do see have a bit more legs.
Yeah, and look, and we had a similar policy, our own sort of view on this back in 2018-19. You know, we were saying back then, look, you know, really negative gearing probably not going to make a lot of difference, and it's very popular in terms of populist, I should say, not popular, populist. But the capital gains tax concession, I think, absolutely is, you know, should be up for review. Now, so who benefits the most from negative gearing? And I just want to give you a few facts from Treasury. They've reported that in the 22-23 tax expenditures and insights statement, 1.3 million people had a rental loss. And so this is about half of the total number of people that had rental deductions. So roughly 50% of the people that own investment properties are claiming losses, so claiming negative gearing, taking advantage of negative gearing. And, you know, the Treasury also says negative gearing is not limited to investment properties. Taxpayers may also own other assets such as shares, which can be negatively geared. In 2020 to 2021, 1.2 million men claimed rental deductions and received an average reduction of 8,070, which is almost 2,000 higher than the average for women, interestingly enough. If you go back to last week's episode, we talked to Eliza Rowan about women and property. That sort of fits in with some of their research, CoreLogic's research. And men received 58% of the tax reduction, whereas women received 42% of the tax reduction. More than half of the total tax reduction accrued to those in age cohorts between 40 and 59 years old, which reflects a larger number of rental property owners, higher average deductions, and higher average taxable incomes within those age cohorts. And that's important because obviously if you're in a higher tax bracket, you're going to be paying or you're going to be getting a higher deduction, right? I think that's often, and also, which is interesting from Treasury, they said, we don't know exactly how much of a benefit the capital gains tax concession provides to property owners, as it also covers all kinds of other assets. So again, other assets also have a capital gains tax concession. And so singling out property, I get that, you know, obviously property's got a big target on it, and it's a big topic of, you know, particularly at the moment when affordability is such a pressing issue. But I think that we always have to remember that all investments have the opportunity for negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, once you do make this change, you are going to make properties that looked enticing to investors one day, not enticing the next. And so any properties which you say are a bit more lower yielding, an investor is going to say, look, I just don't want to, I can't afford the cash flow on that negative. And so I'm going to go and buy things that have got higher yield, right? And so, and then you're going to create like these, and they're usually not the places where people want prices to fall, right? Because the high yield thing basically says is that people are willing to rent the properties, but they're not willing to buy the property. So they're actually more affordable, hence why they're higher yielding. And so what you'll see is that investors will have to go there because they'll say, I can't afford the negative cash flow and the negative gear. And so what you basically will see is that owner-occupier rates will go up dramatically. Every time a property sells, it will never sell to an investor. So it'll get harder and harder to rent in areas that have got, you know, lower yielding, the higher end of the market. And so, you know, because if you, for example, renting a house in an area right now, whenever that property comes on the market through death, divorce, just the investor decides to cash in for their retirement, yeah, absolutely. If negative gearing goes, that basically will wipe out any investor buying that, unless they're cashed up. But property, you know, buying cashed up residentials, there's better assets to buy if you've got lots of cash, you know. Not many people are just buying up residential property, you know, with no mortgage and then renting it out on the investment market. I mean, they do definitely do that for homes to live in because it's not deductible debt. But just buying investment properties, cash, residential, it's just, I do think there's much better returns you can have in other asset classes, whether it's commercial, whether it's shares, whether it's lots of other things. And so
it can diversify as well. And so there's lots of reasons why you wouldn't choose it, the lumpy asset property. One of the reasons a property's a good asset is, you know, in terms of investment, is the fact you can leverage, you can borrow. But then, of course, that plays back into the negative gearing argument. But, you know, I think the fact is, if less people can negative gear, then there's going to be less rental properties.
Absolutely.
I mean, because, you know, if, as I said, we've got to look at the type of the profile of the person who is negative, claiming negative gearing, not the volume of the dollars. You know, if you look at the volume of the dollars, there's less people claiming at that higher tax brackets than in the lower tax brackets. So I guess, you know, we've got a question, is this likely to get leaked? You know, is this likely to become, is to turn into some major tax reform? I mean, what do you reckon about that, Chris? Do you think that they're going to do something about it?
Wouldn't surprise me in some ways, you know, like it wouldn't surprise me if they do, you know, they did have it in the election a few years ago, you know, they're in power now, maybe they bring it up, you know, maybe it does allow them to do other things. And I wonder if it's going to, you know, the unintended consequences will be, and I don't know whether they're going to understand the vacancy rates and the issues in the rental market and, you know, whether, you know, that, if that is really understood, maybe they will not have the guts to do it. And maybe it's too big a reform. You know, they did get in trouble for maybe doing too many big reforms back in 2019. They probably learned their lesson. And so I wonder if it's you know, on the table or whether they'll focus on other things. But I do think the housing will be a big surprise in the next budget. I do think there's going to be a real big focus on the cost of living and, you know, inflation, a lot of that is rental growth, you know, and so that's also doesn't align up to removing negative gearing. It's not like it should be the opposite. If anything, you should be increasing, you know, and it's an anti-investor policy. But then there's a lot of issues with land tax going up around the country and things like that. So state governments wanting to target that a little bit. So I think the anti-investor rhetoric isn't going to go away when prices are going up. And particularly when you look at new loan flows, it looks like investors are starting back in the market, but I think that's actually a good thing to be replacing the investors leaving the market. I would say it's not one for one. It's actually more investors leaving than entering.
Yeah. And, you know, and obviously it doesn't help the story if you're wanting to get them to be a bit more, have some restraint around any changes. I mean, look, I think that it's feasible to expect there's going to be some changes. We talked about CGT concession anyway, and you know, we can see that that's really reasonable to look at that. Negative gearing, maybe less so. We'll run through some options that we're sort of dreamt up coming up. I think it's important to understand that the two major parties, Labor and Liberal, neither of them say that they want to change it. They both say that they support the current investment property tax concessions. Dutton's, you know, categorically ruled out the coalition making any changes to them. But, you know, in Labor's, I think the AFR was commenting that in Labor's Help to Buy housing policy, there's, you know, potentially an opportunity to do some change, you know, because unless the government agrees to rein in negative gearing and the 50% capital gains tax discount, the Greens will oppose. And without the Greens, Labor's legislation faces a tough time passing the Senate. So with housing affordability shaping up as one of the main issues before the next election, due by May next year, or this year, I should say, that is a problem for Labor. And it's, you know, I think that there's a lot of people that have benefited from it. There's a lot of that anti-landlord rhetoric that is prevailing, and it just doesn't seem to go away. So, you know, the government did do a backflip on their stage four tax cuts policy that was well received by the electorate. Will this be well received? I don't know. But in the face of the climate around housing, the conversation around housing is very different to what it was back in 2018-19.
I'm on a personal mission to help more people make better property decisions. And you can find out all about what I'm working on at veronicamorgan.com.au. And there you'll find resources for first home buyers, details about my buyer's agent mentoring program, access to suburb help for investors, or if you're looking to buy your dream home or an investment property in Sydney's inner west, eastern suburbs, or lower north shore, you can connect with my team at Good Deeds Property Buyers.
If you're thinking about buying your first home, upgrading to a new one, or purchasing an investment property anywhere in Australia, we would love to carefully guide you through this journey and importantly, get the finance right. Please reach out via our website, wealthful.com.au.
Don't forget that you can download our free full or forecaster report. Which experts can you trust to get it right? TheElephantInTheRoom.com.au.
Yeah, and I think the continual price increases since 2019 have been quite large. You know, that it's been a proper boom. But yeah, I guess it's just, I do think that this whole story around taxes are on the table. I do think that we're seeing issues with payroll tax. We can see where they're going hard at that. You know, the state governments are trying to find any tax they can. Governments are all in a lot more debt than they were, say, 4 years ago, right? And that debt's a lot more costly now under higher interest rates. And so, you know, that's, I mean, any positive tax changes are going to get wound back and more tax is going to be looked to be found. And I think that is an inheritance tax going to come onto the table? This intergenerational, you know, have and have nots, are we going to see, you know, a big policy like that come in? I mean, that would be crazy. Do we see homeownership getting included in, you know, pension tests? And, you know, is there potentially a tax on home growth? Like, I don't know. Like, I think there's going to be even bigger conversations, which they would be even bigger than, you know, changes to negative gearing. So maybe negative gearing is the sort of canary in the coal mine. If they go for that, then they're going to go for other ones.
Yeah. I mean, and look, there is evidence that negative gearing, there is evidence that the claim that negative gearing makes housing less affordable is actually contested, right? The Centre for Independent Studies chief economist, Dr. Peter Tulip, who we have interviewed on the podcast, he says a range of research shows negative gearing and the CGT discount contributes only 1% to 4% to house prices. So that's not a 1% rise. That's the overall price. It's pretty small. Professor of Economics Richard Holden at UNSW has previously advocated for grandfathering existing negative gearing rules and allowing it only for new construction, which we will talk a bit more of because that's sort of his work has helped shape Labor's previous policy. And he says, though, that changes to negative gearing won't be a silver bullet for housing affordability and expanded ownership, and the effect is unclear for the rental market. So these are academics who spend a lot of time in this space, right? Interestingly enough, there's been a lot of talk around the fact that a lot of MPs have more than one investment property. Apparently, two-thirds of the MPs federal MPs have two or more properties, and only the smallest handful of federal politicians rent their primary residence, and at least 14 MPs own four or more homes. Now, I think too that the reality, there was an article with Danita Warren, who's the MBA CEO of the Master Builders Association. Now, you know, everyone's coming out, everyone with vested interests. But I did think that she, yes, sure, the Master Builders Association wants to build lots of properties and wants tax concessions to assist in that. And I think that this is where I think policy will go. I wouldn't be surprised if there's much more that is skewed towards buying brand new. Her argument is that housing supply settings should be firmed up before changes to tax concession for investment for investors. So she's saying that the fundamental principles of economics has not changed. Don't withdraw investors out of the market whilst you're trying to resolve supply constraints. And I think this is the issue, that negative gearing as it currently stands, there's a lot of people using it. What, 1.3 million tax payers use it in the last year. So if you're going to change it and not grandfather any changes, you've got potentially 1.3 million property owners that might decide to get rid of their properties. That's a lot. That's going to have a big impact on the property market if those people all decide to do it at the same time as well. But certainly that's a significant proportion. That's pretty much 50% of the properties that are out there for own, you know, as investment properties that are out there. The government needs to step up. They've got to really ramp up their public housing builds and in order to compensate for that, you know. So this is really got to be very careful in what they do with existing investors. What they do for future investors is a different thing. Right, but I think they've got to be very careful here.
Well, yeah, and I mean, they let's say they do grandfather it, so then people will say, okay, I've got this property, I'm getting negative gearing, you know, I can afford to keep it because I get negative gearing. It's a good asset, so I'm not going to sell it. I do think it's got good growth long term. I might sell it when it goes back to positively geared, you know, but ultimately I'm not going to sell it now because it's negative gear and I've got it grandfathered, right? And so I do think that, you know, and there could be a rush to get in for investors if there's a date in the future. We saw this in 2019, mm-hmm. actually. We saw this mini investor boom driven, yeah. A little bit like Dom Perriott. And he said, oh, you know, if I go to land tax, that won't affect prices. Absolutely, it affected prices. People were buying $1.3 million properties for $1.5 million. That was actually one of the ingredients to kick off the housing recovery.
In Sydney. Yeah.
And then that led to a national recovery, I would say, the confidence. And people said, well, that's what's happening in Sydney, maybe. And I think that, so, you know, yes, you've got a negative gearing benefit, but then the investors entering the market have just forced a new high, which has basically gone in the face of what people thought would happen. Your negative gearing would cause prices to go down. Well, actually, no, it created a mini investor boom. And then the investors didn't sell after that because they might have wanted to sell and bought another investment property, but they didn't sell. So you got less supply on the market because less investors are selling. And so, you know, these are sort of all the how it could affect marginal buyers. You know, does it affect demand? Does it affect supply? Who would sell? You've got to go really deeper and, you know, different suburbs will behave differently. I do believe, though, there'll be suburbs that will absolutely get smashed by this, because if you look at some suburbs that are heavily invested by, driven by investors, you know, more than 30, 40, 50% of properties are, you know, a lot of renters. So those markets have to then become owner-occupier driven, and they're not that enticing for owner-occupiers, and owner-occupiers wouldn't want to pay current prices. And so in this construction, and we haven't got prices going up, because if prices go up, we create more supply. Mm-hmm. Developers can't build cheap enough, you know, for current price. And so if in these areas where it's high density, that have been driven by investors and home buyers, if under current interest rates, they no longer make sense to investors because they can't, there'd be a negative cash flow. And there's a lot of supply in these areas anyway. This is where prices haven't been going up. Then in those markets, you've just created a real swing to owner-occupiers, and you'd actually see a fall in prices. So absolutely, I do think that's where you would see, and those investors would get burnt in those areas where there's an investor hotspot.
All right, so Treasury figures come out and says that the capital gains tax discount is estimated to have saved taxpayers $25.2 billion in 2022-23, so it will cost taxpayers $25.2 billion, however you want to look at that, with more than 80% going to the top 10% of taxpayers, right? And I look at it and I go, of course, because most people, if they sell an investment property at a gain when they've made money on it, usually with most gains, you would think that's going to put them into the top tax bracket. Would that be fair? So it's like a duh moment. Like, of course, for that particular year, they're going to be in the highest tax bracket for that year because the sale of the property and the gain that they made is precisely what put them in that bracket. So to sort of to use that, and I've seen this in a lot of articles, it's like it's a rich person's benefit, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, I wonder if there's any actual work done to work out whether those taxpayers were what their tax bracket was in the year previous and the year after. You know what I mean? Because that's actually useful data here rather than this sort of, it's very compelling, oh my God, it's only the fat cats that are benefiting from this. So, I just think that our debate and discussion around this needs to get a little bit more real, a little bit more nuanced. And, you know, and the other thing too is each negatively geared investment property, right, is one that's available for rent and wouldn't be available for rent without the tax break. You know, the person who owns it probably wouldn't be able to afford to keep it, probably wouldn't have been able to afford to buy it in the first place. And I get that there's this whole idea that, well, you're keeping first home buyers out of the market, but I don't think every single investment property sold is something that is appropriate for, put it this way, I don't think all first home buyers or all renters can become first home buyers if there were less investors. I don't think it's investors that are stopping a lot of people from going from being a renter to being a home buyer. And I think we just have to get a bit real about this.
Yeah, and I think you're right there around, that's a good point around the benefits of tax, CGT being the top tax rate, and absolutely that is likely to be, you know. With the changes to CGT as well, so if you think about it, okay, the negative gearing changes could happen, but if the CGT changes, if you've got a property that is on a lower CGT rate, I bought a property, let's say it was a house in Sydney, right? And I bought it for $1 million, now it's worth $2 million, right? But land tax, I think, is a real good way to target them to sell because they're like, oh, you know, the cost of owning this investment property. And I do think that's going to continue. It's really happening in Victoria. Mm. But putting that aside, that person doesn't really want to sell it, you know, and whether it's a house or it's another good investment, because they're going to have to pump, you know, $250,000 to the ATO if they sell, right? But if you say to them, look, that opportunity is gone. Like, if you want to sell, the next time you buy an investment property, you don't get that tax deduction. You can only have to pay 37% capital growth tax. Plus, you can't get negative gearing. But I do think they'll hold on. And so, some of these properties that are completely undersupplied right now, because homeowners are getting locked in homes, they can't afford to upgrade, they haven't got the borrowing capacity, they don't want to do it under higher rates, they just can't make it happen. Supply's really tight. And then if you remove this, investors that are just selling because they want to repurpose their funds and they go, oh, actually, I want to hold on to it now. I know I could sell it. I know I probably should sell it, but I don't want to lose that lower CGT. I do think that could, you know, reduce supply and then actually increase prices because, you know, demand's not the issue, right? Supply is what we need to slow price growth. We need supply to increase. And if you then reduce supply, you then create more competition on a fewer number of properties. And I think that's because there's no real investors playing in this market anyway. So it's not like demand's going to decrease. If anything, demand's going to increase because people will say, I don't pay any CGT on my home, but if I make a gain on an investment property, now it's 37%, plus I can't get negative gearing, I'm actually going to upgrade my home. So what you would do in these suburbs is increase demand. People will go more in on their homes, and then those investors will be less likely to sell those investment properties. And so you would decrease supply. And that's unfortunately the mechanism that you would create with this one policy change. It's a little bit like when they changed the rules around overseas expats. And they said, right, if you don't sell your property in Australia by this date, then you have to pay full freight CGT. And so what you've done is create all these expats around the world that just won't sell their properties in Australia because they can't afford to pay the CGT tax. So they just hold on to their investment properties in Australia. Because they didn't get in between that day. And that date, coincidentally, was in COVID and they couldn't sell it anyway. And it's a real issue. And so this unintended consequence, I think, will play out. And then everyone will be like, oh, I didn't do what I thought it was going to do. And now it's actually more expensive to buy it. Oh, God, why don't I care for what you wish for?
There's been some modelling that was just published in the Australian Economic Papers that finds that the share of households who own their own home other than renting would climb to 4.7% if negative gearing is removed. Now, I look at that and I go, okay, do investors really drive up house prices in owner-occupier areas? I don't think they do. You know, I honestly, there's a certain locations where investors absolutely push prices up and maybe they push out first home buyers. But typically in areas of high demand, when I go to auctions, I'm not seeing investors outbidding owner-occupiers in inner Sydney. You know what I mean? So this is, you know, it's great to see this sort of data around there and they've done this modelling, but not all areas and markets perform the same way. They won't, you know, and I think there's a lot of number crunchers out there that don't necessarily understand the human behavioural characteristics of the property market and how it plays out. And I think also another fact, you know, we talked about Treasury facts before, 71% of investors stop at one investment property. That comes from the ABS, right? So I guess how many people own, and you touched on this earlier, Chris, how many people owning more than one actually negatively gear? You know, isn't it more likely that they've got cash flow neutral or positive properties in order to be able to borrow for the next property? You know, it's unusual you find somebody negative gearing multiple properties. But once again, there's this rhetoric that, you know, and Bill Shorten used to do it. Why should one person be able to buy their sixth, you know, investment property and lock out a first home borrower? And back in 2018, when he was saying that a lot, there was something like 2% of all investors own five or more properties. 2%. You know, it's like it's populist and it's really, really horrible. I think, you know, when you've got sort of policies from the Greens talking about freezing rents and removing negative gearing, you know, the consequences of that is less available properties to rent, you know. Public housing is needed. It takes a long time to build. And while they're building it, while they're putting in place, you know, build to rent, public housing and various other measures to increase the stock of rental apartments, or rental properties, they really need to not attack existing investors. And there is a lot of misconception and a lot of articles, you know, feed into this sort of misconception about negative gearing, you know, unfairly, you know, it helping one tiny segment of the society, where it really neglects to look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, and I do think one of the best ways to slow down those big portfolio investors is to really cut their borrowing capacity. And that's absolutely already happened, right? When I started in broking, you know, there were so many ways you could get around bank servicing calculators. They all had quirks. Some of them had like just genuine flaws in them, you know, like where they just were, you know, a gap where they put the wrong, it just wasn't calculated right. Like you could put in a current interest rate and it wasn't buffered through this bank, or you could play it across different banks and they would look at things differently. And, you know, it was completely different 2013, 2014. And you could borrow 10, 12, 14 times income, like particularly when you started going to second tier lenders. APRA kind of figured this out 2015, 2016. And they started going, hey, banks, why don't you send me your serviceability calculators? And they're like, hang on a sec. That's not right. You can't do that. And then they started really hammering down on, you know, the way the banks do it. And now that's really reduced it. And it's particularly with this 3% buffer, like it's hard to get huge borrowing capacity. And so, yeah, absolutely, if you've got an astronomical income, but usually people with astronomical incomes have usually got big debts already. And so I don't think there's like lots of crazy capacity to, you know, build these big portfolios. So, you know, that's not really what's happening.
So here's the real numbers, right? So I'll run through these real numbers and then we'll run through some of the options that we think might happen if things do change. And then we can wrap up this rant on negative gearing, capital gains tax. 71.5% of investors hold one investment property, right? So this is according to the ABS. 18% hold two. 9.7% hold three, four, or five. Right, so it's, sorry, 9.7, did I say 19? So just shy of 10% owns three or four or five, and 0.8%, so that's less than 1% of investors, hold six or more. That's actually changed, because it used to be, you know, as I said, it was slightly more that owned more properties back
yep.
with the last sort of data back in 2018. So the actual percentage, I think, owning two has gone up slightly. The percentage owning one has gone down slightly. The percentage owning six or more has gone down. So if we're talking about the people owning six or more investment properties, we've got to remember, put it all in perspective, it's less than 1% of the investors out there. It's a tiny proportion. And yet that is where a lot of this investor bashing comes from. And you will hear that. Why should someone get to buy their sixth property? The investor age groups, I think this is sort of a bit interesting as well. 24.5% age between 55 and 64, 22.5% between 45 and 54, 21.5% between 35 and 44, and it obviously it starts declining. You've got 12.5% age between 25 and 34, 12% aged more than 65, between 65 and 74, and there's, 1.5% age between 15 and 24, right? So I think that there's always misconceptions around, that our rules reward bad behavior. That was one article written by an academic, because it's like encouraging people to buy poorly performing assets and rewarding them for it. But the reality is that if things change, and if one of the things that, is highly likely to get through is that they make it on new properties only. Back in 2017, they changed the depreciation to incentivize more people to buy brand new. And the reality is that they there's less evidence that they're good investments long term than an existing property. And so the changes could be really encouraging. So that would be a change to negative gearing, which incentivized people to buy brand new to the exclusion of existing. That's actually rewarding bad investing behavior, in my view.
Yeah, and I don't know whether investors will fall for it. It's a different market. Post 2015, I think there's a lot of news around defects. I think there's a lot of evidence now around their performance over the last decade versus other asset class. I think, and what you just see, create investor guides. It doesn't take a rocket science to think through. If this is forcing all the investors there, and home buyers don't want to go there, then it's just going to become an investor hotspot, and that's exactly what drives prices. And so I don't think that's, and also I don't think investors are going to be able to wanting to pay the amount to actually make it feasible to actually build these things. And so, so then you're basically destroying the investor market altogether. And that just not what, is going to be great for a rental market.
And that's the problem. And politically, you can see this argument shaping up, right? That, oh, well, we need to be increasing supply. And so how about we just leave negative gearing in place for people who are prepared to buy a new property, and then therefore that increases supply. That's doing something positive. This argument has been around since Keating, right? And so there is this argument that negative gearing is bad because it encourages investors to buy existing homes, not new homes. And even though there is a greater incentive even now. And so therefore they're not contributing to increased supply. However, that sort of policy that supports building new is actually detrimental to many of the investors who get lured into it. And there's a reason why smart investors go for existing over new. And the problem is, of course, you can see what's going to happen. If that does come about, they're going to be, the spruikers, the rise of the spruikers are going to get a whole new wave of property spruikers selling, in new house and land packages to investors. But there are two aspects to this negative gearing argument. There's encouraging new investors or existing to increase their portfolio. That's what they're saying, that basically that's what negative gearing does. And also preventing existing investors from selling up and putting further pressure on rent. So if you want to fix supply and you want to go and target unsophisticated investors, you'll go and buy the sorts of property. They won't really be great investments, but hey, they're going to get heaps of depreciation. You're going to give them negative gearing. Fine. But I don't think we should be looking at targeting existing investors and putting anything in place that's going to give them a reason to sell up and put further pressure on rents. I think we should quickly just run through some of the possible options, right? So I think that they could reduce capital gains tax discount, right, to reflect lower inflation since the 50% deduction was brought in. We could have a capital gains tax discount sliding scale to incentivize people to hold investment properties for longer. They could put negative gearing and say, we're not going to offer it on subsequent properties. You get one chance, you get to use it once, and that's it. And that's pretty much the Greens policy, I do believe. You could only offer it to new builds, as we've talked about. You can see how that'd be politically palatable and how that sort of they can craft a message around that. They could look at the one-year rule. Like, so there's the capital gains tax concession that doesn't apply if you sell within 1 year. They could extend that exclusion zone, if you want to call it. They can make it not claimable against wages or negative gearing. They can make that negative gearing is only claimable against other investment income. That's something that maybe they'll do. I think most people won't understand that. That's the sort of thing that could get through without anyone realizing what's happening. They could put forward that it's not available on all costs, because technically negative gearing is meant to be costs incurred in generating an income, and you could maybe decide to split it out for rental income and capital growth and say, well, you can't claim interest on the capital growth component, you only can claim on the income. So it can get a bit complicated, try to working that one out. So there's a number of options that they've got. There's probably others. You got any others you want to add to it?
No, I do think that's really important, though, to talk about, is that, it's fine, this be this black and white change, you can't do it. There might be these rules around it. And, that might benefit some less than it benefits others, and it might affect some more than others. And I think this is one of the things, is that when there is an attack on inequality, though. However, I don't know whether attacking negative gearing is going to get that outcome.
It's not going to solve it. It's going to create more inequality, because the people that take advantage of negative gearing will be buying really shit assets.
Yeah. And I think that's and then also the people who don't lose negative gearing, if it's across a whole portfolio, let's say, maybe they've got other investment income that offsets the losses on their property. And so they are getting negative gearing because it's offsetting their gains or their investment income on other assets. And the wealthy go, well, that doesn't matter, I'm still negative, my whole investment portfolio is still up. And so, there is an attack on super, big balances in super. And, that's quite reasonable when you think of some of the biggest balances in super. But you've got to also argue, is it good for someone to try to build wealth for their future and their family, and taking off the age pension and our public resources? And is it wise to even save? You should argue whether it's investors are bad. Well, is saving bad? If that's all we're really investing is, it's just, instead of leaving the money in the bank, it's looking at other ways to use that money. And so I think I'd be really careful with that scarcity mindset and try to, put investors in this bad camp, they're bad people. Are they really just doing things that, for their families? And does that affect other people? Yeah, I don't think they're kind of trying to do it for that reason. They're just trying to get their family ahead. And is that a bad thing? I don't know. And so I think there's a real conversation there that sometimes people go down the wrong view. And I even had a client do this recently who basically said, I don't want to buy investment property because I'm worried about the my kid's future. And so what if you don't buy an investment property for them? How is that going to, are they going to say, thanks, Dad, for not buying me investment properties 20 years' time? How are you actually going to help them if that's the future? So, don't hate hate the system, but don't maybe still play the game.
I think just to sum up our position, really, don't move the goalposts for existing investors, and if the government makes it only available for new builds, watch the rise of the property spruikers. True property investment will only be for those who are already wealthy, which we already see, and you're talking about the inequality there. But everyone else could just line up to lose money and go backwards. And I think that this is the problem with this very simplistic understanding of really what makes a good investment property and investment decisions. So I hope that you found that useful. I wanted to sort of break apart what's being discussed out there. We shall watch with interest.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people think that we've got a self-interest here. They think that, ultimately it wouldn't really affect anything that we're doing. We would just move with whatever change there is. From a broking point of view, people would still be borrowing money. From a buyer's agency point of view, people would still be buying homes. And if anything, home ownership, so that would actually benefit your business from negative going away.
We help more owner-occupiers than we help investors anyway, so it won't make much difference to my business.
Yeah, and our personal situation, we would just do things that we would, go with the times. We wouldn't be trying to hold on to something. And I think that's just something that sometimes people assume, that because we were trying to force some strategy. It's not that. It's, we would just evolve with the times. Lending's still going to be there. Home buying's still going to be there. People are still going to buy investment properties. That's not what's driving our conversation.
No, we just want everyone to think about it a bit deeper. Thank you for listening.
If you have a question that you'd like us to answer in an upcoming Q&A episode, you can send us a voicemail or written question via the website, theelephantintheroom.com.au, or you can email us directly at questions at theelephantintheroom.com.au. If you like what you're hearing, please share this episode with others you feel would benefit. And while you're at it, why not leave us an iTunes review? 5 stars would be great. I know that sounds a bit cringy, but we have it on good authority that every review helps make it easier for other people to find out about us and hear what our amazing guests have to say.